So imagine thousands of pagers
Oh, man.
just simultaneously detonating in the pockets of operatives all across the Middle East.
It's wild. It sounds completely made up.
Right. It sounds like something pulled straight out of like a paranoid cyber thriller. But that actually happened.
Yeah, it really
It
did.
was this moment where a deeply entrenched, heavily armed militant group, one that, had spent decades projecting this aura of just absolute untouchable
Yeah,
machismo,
that's the perfect word for it,
good,
machismo.
was completely dismantled. And not by like a massive bombing campaign, but by a quiet, decentralized supply chain infiltration.
Exactly.
So welcome to the deep dive. We are tackling a massive paradox today because, well, if you only look at your news feed lately,
Which is pretty depressing these days.
so depressing. Or if you read the major political science reports in the last few years, you would absolutely think we're living in the twilight of global freedom.
Right, you see the headlines, and it's all about strongmen taking over, the press getting shut down.
Exactly. Autocracy just feels like this unstoppable creeping tide.
No. It really does feel like a foregone conclusion, when you look at the political indices. There's this prevailing mood of, well, democratic defeatism.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, we see these ruthless leaders consolidating power at home, and we instinctively assume that their domestic brutality will just automatically translate into geopolitical invincibility.
Right, like if they're scary at home, they must be scary everywhere. Wait, actually, no. That assumption is precisely what we're blowing up today.
Yes, we are.
The mission for this deep dive is to unpack this completely fascinating newsletter published in May 2026 by No Opinion.
It's such a good piece.
It really is. It completely rewired how I view global affairs because it points out this glaring contradiction. Like, on paper, the think tanks say freedom is dying. But on the actual battlefield, where theory, crashes into metal and logistics,
Where it actually matters.
right, on the battlefield, tyrants are suddenly dramatically losing wars.
What's fascinating here is the underlying tension. Like, the thread that connects everything we're going to talk about today is the mismatch between a rigid, centralized hierarchy and the chaotic, highly adaptable reality of modern conflict. We're really looking at what happens when a top-down authoritarian model, which relies entirely on fear and control, collides with decentralized technology.
And highly motivated populations, right? So here's how we're going to navigate this today. We're going to start by looking the monster in the eye, so to speak.
Okay.
We'll examine the very real, very gloomy data on the decline of democracy. Then we'll pivot to the battlefield realities in the Middle East and Ukraine to see where that facade is cracking.
The fun part.
Exactly. And finally, we'll dissect the structural, psychological, and, technological mechanisms that are causing these autocratic systems to collapse from the inside out.
It forces us to ask this fundamental question for you, the listener, to keep in mind. Is the rigid control that keeps a dictator in power domestically the exact same mechanism that guarantees their failure internationally?
Man, that's a great framing. Okay, let's start with the gloomy context. The author of our source doesn't sugarcoat the situation at all, which I appreciate.
No, they lay it all out.
They establish a baseline of fear that, frankly, I think a lot of us share. They cite two major heavyweight reports that came out in 2026. The first is from Freedom House, and I mean, the subtitle alone is enough to ruin your day.
Yeah, it's rough.
It's called The Growing Shadow of Autocracy.
The growing shadow is a very deliberate metaphor, too. A shadow isn't just a static object, It spreads, it consumes the light, and it creates an environment where things become obscured. Freedom House is measuring very specific indicators here. They're looking at civil liberties, political pluralism, the safety of journalists.
All the vital signs of a democracy.
Exactly. And their data shows a global, measurable downward trajectory.
Yeah, and the second report the source brings in completely reinforces that. It's the 2026 VDEM report. For those who might not track these acronyms, VDEM stands for the Varieties of Democracy Project.
It's a huge deal in political science.
Massive. It's this enormous academic undertaking that measures the health of governments worldwide. The subtitle of their 2026 report is Unraveling the Democratic Era.
With a question mark.
With a question mark. But, the data inside screams that the unraveling is very, very real.
When both Freedom House and VDEM align like this, it establishes a really powerful consensus. These aren't just like op-eds.
Right, it's not just some guy's opinion.
No, these are organizations tracking thousands of data points across decades. They are looking at judicial independence, electoral integrity, censorship. The author uses this consensus to paint the backdrop. The paper shadow of autocracy is undeniably large.
And intimidating.
Yeah.
Now, the author gets incredibly specific about where this unraveling is happening, and they point the camera directly at the United States.
Yeah, this part is intense.
It is. And I want to pause right here and be absolutely clear with you, the listener. We are strictly analyzing the arguments presented in this newsletter. We aren't endorsing a political platform. And we certainly aren't taking partisan sides here.
Right, that's really important to state.
Our job is just to impartially break down the author's premise so we can understand their broader geopolitical thesis. We're just the messengers for the source material.
That's the exact right approach. We need to look at the domestic U.S. situation exactly as the author models it, because it's basically the linchpin for their whole argument about global power vacuums.
Okay, so impartially reporting the source's claims here. The text states that both Freedom House and VDEM note a rapid deterioration in freedom under Donald Trump's second administration.
Uh-huh.
The author lists very specific examples to build this case. They point to attacks on free and fair elections, the active persecution of critics within the press, and what the source describes as the rise of a violent and unaccountable security state.
Right. So the author is mapping out the classic symptoms of democratic backsliding. But the larger point they're driving toward isn't just about domestic U.S. politics.
No, it's bigger than that.
Much bigger. It's about the international ripple effect. The core argument here is that the United States is fundamentally abandoning its 20th century identity.
The arsenal of democracy. That's the phrase the author uses. And man, it carries so much historical weight.
It really does.
You hear that phrase and you think of the 1940s, right? American factories churning out bombers and tanks to fight fascism or, you know, the Cold War deterrence network. The author's premise is that this era is officially over.
Yeah, they're saying the U.S. is no longer willing or maybe even capable of playing that guarantor role anymore.
Which creates a massive structural vacuum in the international order. Because if the arsenal of democracy shuts its doors and pulls up the drawbridge, geopolitics abhors a vacuum.
Oh, absolutely. Someone else is going to step in. And the source identifies exactly who is stepping into that industrial void.
China.
China.
The text labels China as the new industrial hegemon of the 21st century. But they aren't stepping in to uphold the old, you know, rules-based order. According to the author, China is actively propping up an autocratic axis.
And this axis specifically includes Russia, Iran, and North Korea.
Let's talk about the strategic logic of that axis, because it's pretty calculated.
It's very calculated. The author argues that China's goal in supporting these satellite powers is to keep its potential rivals off balance. It's a strategy of distraction, basically. Proxy pressure.
Like keeping the West busy.
Exactly. Yeah. By keeping Russia resupplied or keeping Iran's economy afloat, China forces the West to constantly fight these geopolitical brush fires. It drains their resources and their political will without China ever having to fire a shot.
So if we stop right here, the narrative is utterly bleak. I mean, you have the historic defender of the free world retreating inward, global indices showing freedom in freefall, and a new industrial superpower arming an alliance of strongmen.
It sounds like the bad guys have already won the century.
It totally does.
Yeah.
On paper, the math heavily favors the autocrats. They have the industrial base, they have the political ruthlessness to act without domestic opposition, and their primary democratic rival is fractured.
But then...
The author delivers the twist,
yeah.
And this is where the entire dynamic just flips on its head.
This is my favorite part of the analysis.
Me too. The source argues that despite this terrifying paper shadow, if you look at the actual physical world, like the literal battlefield, this invincible axis is suffering a string of sudden, staggering collapses.
It really highlights the difference between a system's theoretical capacity and its operational reality under extreme stress.
Okay, let's unpack this with the first piece of evidence the text provides. The Syrian civil war.
Mm.
The author notes that Bashar al-Assad's regime had spent over a decade brutally crushing rebel factions.
A whole decade.
Think about the sheer volume of violence and suppression involved there. And Assad wasn't doing it alone. He was heavily backed by this very axis we just mentioned. Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, they were all pouring in resources to keep him afloat.
It was essentially a fortress of authoritarian support. It was designed to project this idea that once these powers back a dictator, that dictator cannot be removed.
Like a test case for autocratic resilience.
Exactly. A proof of concept for the bad guys.
Yet the source tells us that in late 2024, the Assad regime suddenly fell. that word suddenly just jumps right off the page. I mean, how does a regime survive 10 years of grinding, existential warfare with the backing of major superpowers and then just evaporate?
Well, that suddenness points to a concept we see often in systems theory, which is catastrophic failure. Autocracies are inherently brittle.
Brittle. Not strong, but brittle.
Right. They look incredibly stable right up until the moment they shatter. They don't bend, they break. Because the entire system relies on the perception of invulnerability.
Oh, wow. So if people stop believing they're invincible?
The moment that perception is pierced, the loyalty of the security apparatus just evaporates overnight. Everyone scrambles to save themselves.
And that brittleness isn't confined to Syria. The author's second example looks at the broader Middle East, specifically at Iran's network of proxy forces.
Mm-hmm.
For decades, Iran built this shadow empire to project power. But the text states that this empire is collapsing. They lost Hamas, or mostly lost Hamas, as the source carefully phrases it. And then there is the crown jewel of that shadow empire, Hezbollah.
Now, Hezbollah is a fascinating case study here because it perfectly illustrates the gap between reputation and reality. For years, they were considered one of the most formidable non-state militant groups in the world.
Right. Everyone was terrified of them.
They were heavily armed, highly disciplined, and deeply entrenched.
But the author points out that in 2024, Hezbollah suffered a catastrophic defeat by Israel. And the text explicitly says that this defeat completely belied Hezbollah's fearsome reputation.
Right. To belie means to expose as false. The fearsome reputation was real, sure, but the actual capability to withstand a modern, technologically sophisticated adversary, that was an illusion.
It reminds me of a corporate analogy. Imagine a rigidly managed, highly toxic corporation. You have this terrifying, authoritarian CEO.
Oh, I've seen a few of those.
Right. Middle management is so scared of getting fired, or worse, in a dictatorship, that they just lie. They filter out all the bad news. They tell the CEO the products are great, the market share is secure, the competitors are weak.
Yeah, so on paper, in the boardroom, the company looks invincible.
But there is no mechanism for reality testing.
Exactly. The moment a scrappy competitor launches a truly disruptive product, the whole rigid corporation shatters. They can't adapt because the people at the bottom are too terrified to tell the truth to the people at the top.
And the people at the top are too arrogant to listen. The fearsome reputation of the CEO didn't build a resilient company. It just built a fragile echo chamber.
That corporate information bottleneck maps perfectly onto the military command structures of these authoritarian regimes. Fear fundamentally corrupts information.
Wow, that is such a key insight.
If a mid-level officer in a proxy militia knows their defense lines are weak, but reporting that weakness will get them executed for cowardice, well, they'll just lie and say the lines are strong.
So the dictator at the top makes strategic decisions based on a completely fictional, idealized version of their own strength. Which brings us to the biggest, most undeniable reality check in the world right now.
The main event.
If we want to understand why tyrants are suddenly losing, the author points us directly to the most important geopolitical testing ground on the planet, Ukraine.
Ukraine is where the theoretical vulnerability of the autocratic axis becomes a measurable statistical reality.
The statistics the source provides are simply staggering. We really have to spend some time unpacking these numbers because they illustrate the sheer scale of the failure. According to the text, estimates show that Ukraine is killing 5 Russians for every Ukrainian lost.
A 5-to-1 kill ratio.
A 5-to-1 kill ratio. That's insane.
Let's put that into perspective. In military doctrine, an attacking force usually needs a 3-to-1 advantage in manpower just to overcome a prepared defense. But sustaining a negative 5-to-1 attrition rate over a prolonged period isn't just a difficult tactical situation. It is a demographic and logistical catastrophe. It means the invading force is bleeding out at a rate that is structurally unsustainable, regardless of how big their population is.
And the cumulative toll really reflects that catastrophe. The source notes that by the end of last year, Russia's estimated losses were over 350,000 killed, with total casualties reaching 1.4 million.
That's massive.
1.4 million people removed from the battlefield, the workforce, and society.
We really have to think about the ripple effects of 1.4 million casualties. That isn't just a number on a spreadsheet. That is 1.4 million families affected.
Right.
It's an enormous strain on the domestic healthcare infrastructure. It is a massive depletion of working-age labor in an economy that's already straining under sanctions. The political cost of hiding or justifying those numbers domestically requires an enormous amount of state energy.
Which explains why the narrative of inevitable Russian conquest is factually collapsing.
Mm.
The author points out that Russia isn't just stalling, they are actively losing ground.
Yep.
The text specifically states that Russia lost control of 113 square kilometers in just the past 30 days. But the most revealing detail in this section isn't about the territory. It's about psychology back in Moscow.
You're referring to the Victory Day parade.
Yes. The author notes that Vladimir Putin had to scale down his recent Victory Day parade specifically because he was afraid of Ukrainian drones. Think about the optics of that.
It's a huge deal. Victory Day is the holiest day on the Russian civic calendar. It is the ultimate projection of state power and militaristic pride.
For an autocrat, projecting strength is survival. To shrink your own parade in your own capital because you fear the enemy's technology, that is a profound admission of vulnerability.
It shatters the illusion of invulnerability. If the state cannot protect the airspace over Red Square during its most important martial celebration, the social contract of the autocracy is broken.
Because that contract is basically, we demand your absolute obedience in exchange for security and glory. Right?
Exactly. And they aren't delivering either.
And the author suggests this vulnerability is precisely why Putin recently made a public declaration that the war is coming to an end. It's an attempt to manage expectations before the structural rot becomes completely undeniable.
But this raises the million-dollar question, doesn't it?
It really does. Why is this happening? How does a supposedly weaker nation inflict this kind of catastrophic damage on a supposed superpower?
To answer that, the author introduces their first major structural thesis. It's a concept that goes way beyond just weapons and tactics. They call it the defender's advantage.
Now, usually when we hear defender's advantage in a military context, we think of things like interior supply lines, knowing the local terrain, or having fortified trenches. But the author is talking about something much deeper.
They argue that the core of the defender's advantage is actually moral.
It is the psychology of motivation. In any conflict, you have to ask, what is the fundamental reason a soldier is willing to hold a position under fire?
And the source draws a devastating contrast here. Let's look at the attacking side first. The text points out that Ukraine never threatened Russia. The invasion was entirely unprovoked.
Right.
Because of that lack of existential threat, the author asks, how do you motivate an army? The text argues that Putin can certainly pay desperately poor people to go fight.
You can commodify violence. You can offer a high salary or debt forgiveness to someone with no other economic options, and they will put on a uniform.
But the author follows that up with a critical question. Can Putin persuade regular middle-class Russians to go die for the glory of a new Russian empire?
And the author answers their own question with a flat, not really.
This exposes the limits of imperial ambition in the 21st century. An autocrat might have grand visions of redrawing maps and achieving historical immortality. But a middle-class citizen who has a career, a mortgage, and a relatively comfortable life.
They have zero rational incentive to sacrifice their life for the leader's ego.
Exactly. You cannot manufacture ideological zeal for a war of choice among a population that has something to lose.
Now contrast that with the defender's motivation. The text is very clear about what the Ukrainians are fighting against. They are fighting against the complete erasure of their national identity.
Yeah.
They are fighting against the literal brutalization of their families and their communities and the prospect of being forced into poverty under a hostile occupation.
That is the essence of the moral defender's advantage. When survival is on the line, the threshold for pain, endurance, and sacrifice is astronomically higher.
Makes total sense.
A mercenary fighting for a paycheck will retreat when the risk outweighs the reward. A citizen fighting to prevent their home from being leveled and their family from being harmed will hold the line long after it defies conventional military logic.
It's the difference between fighting for a bonus and fighting for oxygen. You will always fight harder for oxygen.
That's a great way to put it.
And what I find fascinating is that the author doesn't just apply this moral framework to Russia and Ukraine. They use this exact same mechanism to explain another conflict, pulling the United States back into the analysis.
Again, we're looking at how the author applies their own theoretical framework to different geopolitical events.
Exactly. Impartially examining the text, the author applies this lesson to what they call Trump's war on Iran.
Right.
The source argues that when Trump launched an unprovoked attack on Iran, the entire dynamic shifted. By attacking without direct provocation, the U.S. inadvertently handed the moral defender's advantage directly to Iran.
The mechanism remains consistent. An unprovoked attack galvanizes the target population. Even if a population dislikes their own autocratic government, a foreign invasion or unprovoked assault often triggers a rally around the flag effect.
They shift into a defensive survival mode.
Exactly.
And conversely, the author looks at the motivation of the attacking population, in this case, the American public. The text states plainly that most Americans disapprove of the war with Iran. Furthermore, they have absolutely no desire to endure the economic blowback, specifically citing high gas prices, just to topple someone else's dictator.
If we synthesize this, the overarching rule the author is establishing is that populations in the modern era simply do not have the stomach for unprovoked wars of choice.
Yeah, that seems to be the core rule here.
Whether it's middle-class Russians refusing to bleed for a new empire, or American commuters refusing to pay $5 a gallon for gas to fund a regime change operation halfway across the world, the attacker is inherently fighting against the apathy or active resistance of their own people.
While the defender, whether it's a democracy like Ukraine or an autocracy under attack, is fighting with the ferocious, unified will of survival.
Exactly.
So the moral will to fight is a massive vulnerability for an autocrat fighting a war of choice. But wars are incredibly complex systems. They aren't just fought by individual soldiers relying on grit.
No, not at all.
They require enormous logistics, industrial capacity, and most importantly, international alliances. What happens when these strongmen inevitably get bogged down and need help from their friends?
Well, this brings us to the author's second major structural thesis. If the first flaw was psychological motivation, the second flaw is organizational. We can call it the big man alliance problem.
Oh, I love this part.
It exposes a fatal flaw in the very DNA of authoritarian diplomacy.
The text sets up a very stark dichotomy here. It states that democracies tend to cooperate. And we see the proof of concept in the text itself. The author notes that Ukraine has managed to survive largely because it is backed by staunch support from European countries.
That is the nature of democratic alliances like NATO or the EU. They are often incredibly frustrating, slow, and bureaucratic.
So much bureaucracy.
Right. They require endless debate, consensus building, and compromises. But because they are built on a foundation of shared interests and institutionalized cooperation, they are remarkably durable under pressure. They are networks of peers.
Autocracies, on the other hand, do not know how to be peers. The text explains that authoritarian regimes are fundamentally built on dominance.
Yes.
The author looks at the psychology of dictators like Putin and Xi Jinping, or what the source terms populist strongmen like Donald Trump, and concludes that their ultimate driving goal is to dominate everyone else.
In the mindset of an autocrat, power is a zero-sum game. If you have power, it means I have less power, therefore a relationship of mutual equality is inherently threatening.
The author perfectly distills this psychology into a single phrase, including the other autocrats.
Yeah.
They want to dominate everyone, including the other autocrats.
Yeah.
You cannot have a functioning alliance if everyone in the room is constantly scheming to assert absolute submission over everyone else.
Hmm.
The author writes, someone has always got to be the big man.
Someone has always got to be the big man. That is the Achilles heel of the autocratic axis right there. It means trust is structurally impossible. It means their alliances are purely transactional, based on a temporary alignment of hatred for a common enemy rather than a shared vision for a stable future.
And the source provides a fascinating real-time example of this dysfunction. We go back to the relationship between Russia and China. We established earlier that China is the new industrial hegemon, right? The arsenal of this autocracy.
Right.
But the text points out that while Russia is ostensibly China's ally, China has been extremely circumspect with its aid.
If we look closely at that word, circumspect, it reveals the entire dynamic. Why would China hold back? Why not fully unleash their industrial might to help Russia crush Ukraine?
Because Xi Jinping doesn't want Vladimir Putin to be a peer.
Precisely. If China helps Russia win a rapid, decisive victory, Russia emerges stronger, more independent, and more arrogant. China doesn't want a strong, independent partner in Moscow. They want a dependent, isolated junior partner.
They want a subordinate.
Yes. They want a client state that relies on Chinese technology and buys Chinese goods without ever challenging Beijing for the title of the big man.
It's a parasitic relationship disguised as an alliance. China is perfectly happy to let Russia bleed out in Ukraine, absorbing Western resources and attention, as long as Russia doesn't completely collapse. But they will never treat Russia as an equal.
No, never.
Now, here's where this gets profoundly interesting, and where the author's argument takes its final, most devastating turn. If autocracies are paralyzed by this paranoid need for dominance, If they cannot form cooperative alliances, how does that affect their ability to adapt?
This is the critical piece.
How does a system that relies entirely on top-down control handle an environment that demands rapid, decentralized innovation?
You're hitting on the core vulnerability here. When trust is absent and control is centralized, information flow stagnates. And in modern conflict, stagnant information is a death sentence.
This brings us to a quote from the source that I think is the thesis statement for the entire geopolitical era we are entering. The author writes, "Ruthlessness and machismo will only get you so far in a technological world."
That's it. That's the whole ballgame.
I'm going to repeat that because it's so crucial. Ruthlessness and machismo will only get you so far in a technological world.
It completely reframes our understanding of strength. We are conditioned to view a leader who, you know, purges their generals, silences the press, and projects a hyper-masculine, iron-fisted image as strong.
Like the classic dictator playbook.
Exactly. But the author is arguing that this specific type of 20th century brutality is an active liability against a 21st century technological adversary.
The text points out that the civilizations these tyrants are attacking are usually technologically superior. And the author provides two distinct, jaw-dropping examples of the nerd's revenge.
The nerd's revenge, I love that.
We see exactly what happens when top-down brutality tries to fight decentralized, bottom-up innovation. Let's look at the first example, which takes us back to the Middle East and the defeat of Hezbollah. We discussed earlier that the text called it a catastrophic defeat that belied their fearsome reputation. But here, the author explains the mechanism of how they were defeated.
And the method of defeat is more important than the defeat itself.
The source states that Israel didn't just bomb them into submission in a traditional sense. They defeated Hezbollah using pinpoint decapitation strikes. And how do they do it? By blowing up their pagers.
Let's analyze the mechanics of that operation. Hezbollah relied on its reputation for rugged, militant machismo. They had underground bunkers, stockpiles of rockets, fiercely loyal fighters.
Right.
But a modern military didn't engage them muscle to muscle in the valleys of Lebanon. Instead, an intelligence apparatus infiltrated the global supply chain, compromised the communication devices that the organization relied on for secure logistics, and triggered a synchronized systemic collapse from the inside out.
It renders the big muscles completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
You can have the most loyal, ruthless foot soldiers on Earth, but if your command structure is decapitated by the very communication devices they carry in their pockets, your machismo means absolutely nothing. It's brains bypassing brawn entirely. And the second example of this technological disparity is even broader in scale. The text brings us back to the war in Ukraine. The author argues that Russia is starting to lose not because Ukraine has more troops, but specifically because the Ukrainians are more inventive.
Inventiveness is the ultimate asymmetrical weapon.
The source claims that Ukraine has essentially invented an entirely new form of warfare, specifically to defeat the Russians. We are talking about drones. And we are talking about a few experimental prototypes. The text states that Ukraine's drone industry has hit its stride, producing several million drones a year.
Billions. The scale is difficult to comprehend. We are witnessing the shift from warfare dominated by expensive, exquisitely engineered, massed artillery platforms to warfare defined by swarms of cheap, highly adaptable, expendable technology.
And the impact is devastating. The author notes that these long-range Ukrainian drones are inflicting massive pain on Russia. Specifically, the text points out they're actively destroying Russian oil infrastructure and shutting down Moscow's airports. A nation with a fraction of Russia's defense budget is crippling the Russian energy sector, using flying robots assembled in decentralized workshops.
We have to ask why Russia cannot counter this. They have a massive defense ministry. They have state-owned weapons manufacturers. Why can't they out-innovate the Ukrainians?
Right, why not?
Because innovation, especially in software and emergent technologies like drone warfare, requires a decentralized, iterative approach. It requires venture capital logic.
Oh, interesting.
You need thousands of engineers who are empowered to try a design, fail, tweak the code, and try again the next day. You need a bottom-up network where the people in the trenches can communicate directly with the programmers in the labs without waiting 6 months for a defense ministry committee to approve a design change.
And that is the exact opposite of how an autocracy works.
Precisely. Totalitarian systems suffocate bottom-up inventiveness. The author states it beautifully. Big muscles don't do much against exploding drones, nor do they help plan complicated logistics or produce innovative new technologies.
Yeah, that's a great quote.
If an authoritarian general is terrified of being punished for failure, he will never authorize experimental drone programs. He will stick to the old, approved methods, massed infantry and artillery, even as his forces are picked apart by a swarm of million-dollar tech innovations built for $500 apiece.
It really is like watching a dinosaur trying to fight a swarm of aggressive bees. The dinosaur has size, it has teeth, it has armor, but the bees are small, they are networked, they adapt, and they strike at the vulnerabilities.
That's a really vivid way to picture it.
Now, as compelling and optimistic as this analysis is regarding the fragility of dictatorships, the author is a rigorous thinker, and they do not let us off the hook that easily.
No, they don't.
The source includes a vital caveat at the end of the text. I want to make sure we address this so we aren't painting an overly utopian picture.
Yes. The author provides a necessary, sobering reality check.
The text explicitly states, "I hope people don't interpret this post as a claim that liberal democracies are inherently stronger than autocracies." The author is warning us against complacency. Simply having a parliament or holding elections does not cast a magic shield over your country.
Right.
And again, maintaining our strict neutrality and reporting the author's exact framing regarding U.S. politics here, the source writes that Trump is a fool, but the new axis might yet rally.
So the question becomes, what is the mechanism that could allow this failing autocratic axis to rally? If they're lacking moral motivation, if they can't form true alliances, and if they are failing technologically, what is their lifeline?
The author points back to the very beginning of the piece. The danger is that they could be backed by the awesome technological and industrial might of China.
Oh, right. Back to China.
If China stops being circumspect and decides to fully engage, if Beijing decides that allowing Russia or Iran to collapse is a bigger threat to Chinese security than facing Western sanctions, the equation changes.
It changes completely.
If the autocratic axis is suddenly fueled by the one autocracy that has managed to build a massive high-tech industrial base, the author acknowledges that the threat remains existential.
It's a crucial caveat. The current failures we are analyzing, the exploding pagers, the millions of drones, the collapsing proxies, these are symptoms of specific vulnerabilities right now. But vulnerabilities can be subsidized.
That's a scary thought.
If the Chinese industrial engine is fully attached to the Russian war machine or the Iranian proxy network, it could mask those structural flaws through sheer volume.
So we have traversed a massive amount of conceptual terrain today. We started with the terrifying data from Freedom House and VDEM, looking at the encroaching shadow of autocracy. We looked at the sudden, baffling collapses of Assad and Hezbollah.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We analyzed the staggering arithmetic of the Ukraine war. We unpacked the psychological dysfunction of the big man alliance. And we examined how the rigidity of tyrants makes them sitting ducks for decentralized, bottom-up technological warfare.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? How should this reshape how you read the news tomorrow morning?
That is the ultimate question. Because if you only read the headlines about political crackdowns, or if you only look at the indices measuring civil liberties, the future looks incredibly dark.
Very dark.
It looks like the strongmen have figured out the ultimate hack for consolidating power and that open societies are just too messy to survive.
But the core insight of this entire analysis is that political consolidation is not the same thing as systemic resilience. In fact, they are often inversely correlated.
Exactly. When we rip our eyes away from the political polling and look at the brutal, unsparing mechanics of actual conflict, the reality flips.
It really does.
When we ask who actually has the moral will to endure hardship because they are defending their own homes rather than fighting for a dictator's historical fantasy.
Right.
When we look at who can build real institutional alliances based on shared interests rather than fragile, paranoid hierarchies where everyone is obsessed with being the big man.
The big man problem again.
And crucially, when we look at who can organically innovate, who can unleash the nerd's revenge to build millions of drones in a high-tech world while the autocrats are busy suffocating their own inventors out of fear of losing control.
Tyranny suddenly looks incredibly dangerously fragile.
It does. Ruthlessness, as it turns out, is a catastrophic substitute for inventiveness.
It forces a profound reevaluation of power in the 21st century. The capacity to silence a journalist or poison a political opponent requires brutality. But the capacity to manage global logistics, foster software innovation, and maintain complex, trusting alliances, that requires adaptation.
Yeah.
The rigidly controlled systems are failing the test of reality because reality is increasingly complex and decentralized.
Which leaves us with a truly fascinating paradox to ponder. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over long after this deep dive ends.
Okay, let's hear it.
We have spent decades fearing the top-down absolute control of authoritarian regimes. We fear their ability to mobilize resources without the messy debate of a legislature, to act ruthlessly without the accountability of an electorate.
Sure.
But in a world that is hurtling toward unpredictable, rapidly evolving, highly decentralized technology, a world where a multi-million-dollar tank can be destroyed by a swarm of cheap drones engineered by a decentralized network of citizens.
Yeah.
A world where a 40-year-old militant command structure can be erased by an infiltrated supply chain of pagers. Mm-hmm. Is the rigid top-down control of a dictator actually their greatest vulnerability?
Wow.
Does the exact system of terror and central control that guarantees their survival at home practically guarantee their obsolescence on the modern technological battlefield?
That is the question we all need to be asking.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives, look past the paper shadows, and we will catch you next time.